Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Today is Monday. It's January 14th, 2019, and it's 5:08 in the morning. Thanks for being here with us on another edition of The Opening Bell. And another business day and another business week getting underway. We've got a good show for you this morning. In just a few minutes, we'll bring in our first guest, David Hicks, the CEO of HomeVestor. To talk a little bit about the flipping market, the home flipping market in Chicago. Of course, we'll also keep you up to date on the latest news, weather, and sports throughout this hour as well as we move forward. We may have to reschedule our guest, Paul Gossett from Jewel Osco this morning. We'll let you know more about that as we move through the broadcast this morning. But first, let's begin on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk. With some numbers from Wall Street, the opening bell will ring later this morning after a fairly good week last week. Despite some small losses on Friday, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed 6 points lower to 23,996. The NASDAQ lost a little bit of ground as well. The S&P fell just about a point lower as well. As we look at the markets this morning on the futures side of things, futures are pointing toward opening losses when the bell rings later. Dow futures are off nearly a percent this morning. S&P futures are down nearly a percent as well. NASDAQ futures off nearly a percent and a quarter. Oil is trading at $50.74 a barrel, which is down about 85 cents. Around the rest of the globe, markets in Europe are in the red as well. The FTSE is off nearly a percent. The DAX three quarters. In France, the markets are off nearly a percent. And in Asia, markets mixed with the Nikkei up nearly a percent and the Hang Seng down nearly a percent and a third. A couple of stories that we're watching before we get going this morning. Producer prices, retail sales, housing starts, and consumer sentiment highlight this week's economic reports. We'll be watching all of that as well as the government closing the ongoing partial government shutdown. It's already started to affect some airports in Houston and in Florida. Terminals had to be closed over the weekend because not enough TSA agents showed up. China's exports are down the most in 2 years, and that's raising worries about a global economic slowdown. Exports from the world's number two economy fell 4.4% in December compared to December of 2017. China's imports last month were down a staggering 7.6%. The biggest drop since July of 2016. China's exports all of last year rose almost 10% for the strongest performance in 7 years. But December slowdown has analysts worrying that the country is slipping toward a trade recession. Also this morning, job cuts are coming to SpaceX. The firm announced a 10% reduction in its workforce last week, just hours after another successful launch of a rocket full of satellites. A statement from the company to the Los Angeles Times said it must become leaner to better serve its customers. The aerospace company sent an email to all of its employees saying it was offering at least 8 weeks' pay and other benefits to impacted employees. Let's begin front and center this morning with the home flipping market, the Chicago home flipping market. David Hicks is the CEO of HomeVestor and is with us this morning. David, good morning. Welcome to the opening bell.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you for having me on the show.
So is the flipping market still a thing, or is give us some numbers here. Give us a sense, a snapshot, if you will, of how this is going, because I know it was really big a decade or so ago. Is it still going strong?
Well, it is very much for us. We are a little different market than what most of them. Many people don't know HomeVestors, but they see our billboards. We buy ugly houses, and we are growing faster now than we have ever have in our history.
And when you say ugly houses, what do you mean by that?
Well, that is our trademark slogan. Literally, we buy houses that need repair. Most of our franchise, they fix them up. They either resell them to an end user or use them as rental properties.
The goal here is what? I mean, obviously people want to make some money here, but these are becoming pretty good investment properties for folks, aren't they?
Yes, they are. The houses we buy are typically either, we are end users, either a first-time home buyer, or an investor that wants a rental property, or our franchise keepers, rental properties.
Give us a sense for those people who are getting involved in this, what the benefits are here and maybe what some of the challenges are.
Well, the benefits really are, and many people think we're the home flipping, when you go back, is buying foreclosures and that. That's not what we do. We typically buy houses that have been maybe somebody's been in the house for 30 or 40 years that needs repair. It needs that fix, those fixings. So the houses we buy, it's a good deal for the people selling them because they can sell them as is. And our franchise, by putting the effort and the work into them, can improve that house and make good money out themselves.
And that's going to be my next question, obviously. I guess it varies depending ugly house to ugly house, but what kind of money can somebody make on a house like this? What's the market generally? What do you generally pay?
Well, again, it's the houses that we buy, and it's not what we buy, make a lot on one house. Our franchises last year did 11,000 houses nationwide, and so they do a consistent number of houses, and so they can make a real good living doing it if they're consistent at it.
What would be some of the biggest reasons why somebody would get involved with your company? Would it be just the ugly house, or would there be other factors involved in, let's say, wanting to get rid of a home that or property that they have? I'm thinking, you know, maybe it's an economic problem or perhaps the death of a loved one. Maybe it's just a resizing.
Yeah, it's all those things. And I'll give you a good example. My wife and her brother and sister, they inherited a house from their family. The problem is it was, a 40-year-old house, and we live, neither of us is in Boise, Idaho, and none of us, I'm sorry, is in Oregon, and her brother and sister live in Boise, and we don't live there. So how do you sell that house? And so we sold it to an investor that bought it as is. He fixed it up and sold it. A lot of it is inherited houses. A lot of it's houses where people haven't been able to keep it up, that we buy it, and then we do the repairs on it and make it livable again.
Is there any reason why somebody could not take part in HomeVestors in what you do?
Well, we're a franchise company. So those that you're talking about selling a house to becoming
selling
a franchise?
House, yeah, selling a house to you.
Not really. I mean, if a house is really doesn't need repair and it's in great shape, those houses, probably they're going to want to go to a realtor. Realtors don't like selling our houses because they need the repairs. They smell sometimes. And those are the houses that would be most beneficial for somebody selling to us.
David, before we get any further on, I'd like to get a little bit more history of the company. It dates back to 1989.
Our real growth has come since 2009. We've gone from 160 franchises up to over 1,000 today.
Give us a sense of the franchise part of this. I know I asked before the break whether this is something that franchisees can get in and on. Is that the model for HomeVestor?
Yes, that's completely the model. We are a local franchise that buys houses in their local community. And we're in over 160 different communities and cities across the country. I think we have about 19 franchises in the Chicagoland area.
How does somebody get in on the ground floor of something like this? How would somebody become a franchisee?
Well, they need to check us out and do their due diligence. They can find us on homevestorsfranchise.com and find out about the company. There is an application process. We do a background check and check to make sure they have enough resources to get started with us. But the reality is they don't need experience. In fact, we almost prefer people that have not been buying and selling houses. Steve, we get more of what we call corporate refugees, people that are tired of traveling and are used to the support of a corporation, but they want that support, but they want to have their own deal. And so They are independently owned and operated owners of a business, but yet they have the support and the resources and the systems of a big company.
David, you probably have a good vantage point of the housing market from a high level. You get to see all kinds of parts of the country. How does Chicago compare to some of the other markets you're in terms of not only these ugly houses that are out there, but people willing to get rid of them? And the stock, I guess, is the question I'm asking. How do we rank, in your view, with other cities?
Well, Chicago is a great growing market for us. We have a lot of opportunity here. We bought about 150 houses last year in Chicagoland, and so it is a good growing market. As all over the country, the top level of the market is slowing a little bit, but yet with us, we don't see it because we are. We're buying more houses. Our franchises are buying more and selling. There's more demand for small houses now, which is what we typically buy. The builders aren't building the small houses. And so there is a pent-up demand and even a growing demand for those houses for first-time home buyers and for investors that people want to rent houses.
Oh, that's interesting. Why do you think that is? Why the demand for small houses? Why do people want those?
Well, it's just because people, again, first-time home buyers, that's where they start. And as the interest rates have gone up, people lower their expectations of the kind of houses, and the higher-priced houses start getting a little bit out of their price range. But the lower price houses don't. And so the fact that builders aren't building those houses means that there's a lot of people looking for those kind of houses.
One of the selling points of HomeVestor is that it helps maintain the local affordable housing supply. Talk to me a little bit more about that. Why is that important? How does your company do that?
Well, Steve, what we do, literally, we say we improve neighborhoods one house at a time. We take that house that has been neglected and in a neighborhood. Typically, they're older houses, 30, 40-year-old houses, which as people build the new houses further out, the ones that are in closer are the ones we buy because they are those older houses. And so that just... Again, we're recycling neighborhoods.
From the investor side of this, is there anything that those folks should be aware of here? What would you say is the most important information for them?
Well, the most important information I have is literally just that we stay within a market that we're good at. A franchise that is, and even an investor is that are, if they're looking for get rich quick money, this isn't it. If they're looking for money where they can, do good work on a house and make good money on a house, this might be it.
Investors might ask, well, what kind of red tape is involved? Will they deal with a real estate agent? What kinds of financing available? What are the answers to those questions?
Great question. Anybody can buy and sell houses for themselves without being a realtor. Probably half our franchises are not realtors. When they sell to an end user, we typically use a realtor and use the best one in that neighborhood. When we buy, we typically do not. We actually will loan for the franchise to buy a house, and so we help them with that part of it. We also have seven different vendors that love lending to our franchises, and we have a portal where they can literally submit a loan, and we submit it out to all the franchises and all the lenders, and they can all the lenders that fit their model in this particular house. And so we help the franchises find that lending.
Do you do better? Does your company do better in a strong economy like we're in now, or is some other type of economic situation? How are things going with this economy now versus, let's say, 2008?
Well, 2008 was a tough time for some franchises, although the reality is those that stayed in our market did well. We've been through the ups. We've been through the downs. Our franchises can do well in any market. We need a predictable market. 2008 was a struggle because it dropped so fast. As soon as it became predictable, then our franchise did well with it. In fact, we would probably prefer to slow down just a little bit. I think our franchise would, most of them will tell you that that this is almost, has been recently almost a little overheated market.
David, it's very good chatting with you. Where is the best place for folks on either side of this, buyer or investor, to get started to find more information?
Either one of them. If they want to sell a house, go to WeBuyUglyHouses.com. It's probably the easiest way. If they want to find out about being a franchise, go to HomeVestorsFranchise.com.
All right. David, we appreciate you being with us this morning. Please come back and join us sometime.
Thank you, Steve.
David Hicks is the CEO of HomeVestor here on The Opening Bell. Welcome back to The Opening Bell. It's 5:39 now. Thanks for being here with us on our Monday edition. In the CEO spotlight this morning, the head of Jewel Osco. The competition has never been more fierce among local grocery stores. But one local chain has a leader with 40-plus years of experience under his belt. We're happy to have with us Jewel Osco CEO Paul Gossett in our spotlight this morning. Paul, good morning, and welcome to The Opening Bell.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing very well. I'm very excited to talk to you today. It's not every day we get a CEO from a grocery store chain, especially Jewel Osco, to come in and talk to us, so we're happy you're here this morning.
Yeah, glad to be here. You know, it's not a long way from our office to get to downtown Chicago, yeah, since we operate right here in Chicagoland.
Well, I wanted to start by sort of setting the scene for people who are listening about the field. What's the competition like among grocery stores? Where does Jewel Osco fit into that? Maybe we could start there by talking about how competitive this industry is these days. So we'll begin there.
Okay. Well, from a competitive standpoint, I always think back, I can't remember a time when the grocery industry wasn't competitive, where someone would create a better widget and come out with a new way to serve customers. So I would tell you the competitive landscape is expanded with – it was traditionally more one-stop shopping in a regular grocery store. And today there's all kinds of alternatives between the e-commerce, the specialty stores that have seen a resurgence and have something that is unique that they offer that makes it more competitive for us to capture every dollar as we had in the past.
When you sit down in the boardroom or you're in the C-suite and you have the chart up there, who are the other players that you guys are always watching out for?
Well, you know, quite frankly, Chicagoland is a little bit different. There is a tremendous presence of the independent retailers here that don't really exist in any other market. But, of course, it's the big retailers, the Walmart of the world, the Mariano's, Kroger, of the world. Those are the top two, really, with the influence from the Aldis, the Save-A-Lots, and some of the limited offering. Those are really the big ones. And then really anyone that offers e-commerce. You know, we look at e-commerce as a emerging market, and how do we maximize the opportunity to take care of our customers to avoid any loss in sales as the consumer continues to change. And that's always our biggest mm-hmm. challenge. The customer is always changing. How do we keep up with them and get ahead of them?
What is the biggest thing that sets Jewel Osco apart from some of those others?
Well, I would tell you the biggest thing that, and I mentioned it earlier with, you know, Chicagoland is Jewel and Jewel is Chicagoland. We've been here a long time and we have great associates. If you look at the average tenure of the associates in our store, it's well north of over 30 years. People have made their careers working for Jewel. So number one, it's our people. We try to make sure that we stay relevant locally. We have numerous local suppliers that we make sure that we feature and handle in a prominent way. We have local sports affiliates that we try to tie in with former players that have developed new lines, minority ownership, local companies. We make sure that they have a good presence in our store. So we're always trying to make sure, really, that we stay relevant locally, and that's really our strength, as some of the larger companies are run and merchandised, and customer decisions are made from thousands of miles away versus right where we operate.
For the average shopper, that's a big bone of contention. When you go to your Jewel Osco and you find the product that you've always bought, and you go to the competitor and it's something that you've never seen before, this is the kind of stuff that hits home with people in a real way.
Yeah, it's a real interesting dynamic, and there's just things that you don't know when you're trying to run a local supermarket from a distance. You know, prior to being in New England, I never knew what a steak tip was. But a steak tip in Boston is like a T-bone steak in Chicagoland. But if you were sitting on the West Coast, you would never know to promote or support a steak tip item.
Yeah.
So St. Paddy's Day here is a big deal for corned beef. You probably would not write the right promotion to take care of customers if you were trying to run the company from afar.
Let's talk a little bit about your experience. You mentioned earlier the longevity of the folks who work at Jewel Osco. You go all the way back to 1977 with the parent company, Albertsons, with experience in the Northeast and the South. Talk about your background.
Well, I started out in a glamorous position of cleaning the bakeries up in a local supermarket, Albertsons, in 1977. Took two promotions at that time to be able to be a courtesy clerk or a bagger up front. And then I progressed through the store in different positions and ended up running a store. And then ultimately in Portland, Oregon, I was fortunate enough to run the grocery operations for that for the chain there. Then I had, and this could go on and on, it's a long story, but moved from Portland, Oregon to Orlando, Florida, to our Albertsons banner in Florida. From there, I went to Philadelphia and was running all the merchandising and marketing for our Acme stores in Philadelphia. From Philadelphia, I went to Houston and ran our Albertsons banner in Houston. Then I went to a competitor for a few years out of Minneapolis, and then went back to Dallas, Texas, in that particular market. And then from Dallas, went to back to Minneapolis, then from Minneapolis to Boston. And, you know, the thing about Boston, I was there the longest I've been. I was there for 6 years. And it really gave me a chance to set some roots, which I hadn't had in the past, in New England. And I'm looking forward to doing the same thing here in Chicago.
Yeah, you took over for CEO last year, last July?
Last July.
Mm-hmm. How do you like it so far?
Oh, I love it. You know, it's Chicago's a great market. People are great. Our stores are in great shape when it comes to facilities, and our customers are superb. So it's always fun when, you know, the customer votes with their wallet, and we want to continue to make sure that, you know, we're taking care of those customers when they're coming through our doors.
It is striking that this CEO, you as CEO, have this 40 years of experience with a company in all of those different places. How does that help you today run Jewel Osco? How do you draw from that past experience?
Well, I draw upon it for what was successful that worked in those markets. And, you know, the biggest key to business is people. And I keep it pretty simple. I even carry a coin with me that just reminds me in my pocket every day. And it's on the front side, it's all about sales. Sales and sales. And on the backside, the only way I accomplish the front side is with people, 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 whether it be our vendors, our suppliers, our customers, and our associates.
It sounds like you're a CEO that is probably in the C-suite less than they are in actual stores. Is that a fair? Are you in the stores more than you are in the office, or what? How would you describe your?
I'd say it's about 50-50.
Okay.
I like being in the stores. I like seeing where the action is and seeing how customers react and look for the opportunities that we have to serve the customer better.
What are the biggest challenges right now? I know you've sort of touched on a few of them, but if you had to lay out a couple of them right now for Jewel Osco, what would they be?
The challenge is e-commerce, and that segment is not letting up. So we've got the biggest challenge is we've got to crack the code to how we do it better than anyone else in the market. That's one of our big challenges. We have our Drive Up and Go program, which, you know, the customer can order their groceries in advance and then drive to the store. We deliver them out to their car. And that's relatively new. A lot of this is relatively new for us at Jewel Osco. We started a little over a year ago into the e-commerce with home delivery and then the Drive Up and Go feature. That we just recently expanded into 9 additional stores. But those are the big challenges is keeping up with the customer. Their diets are changing. If you were to think back 5 years ago, the number of organic items that were offered in a grocery store were pretty minuscule. Today, it's thousands of items that we carry because the customer is demanding that.
You mentioned the Drive Up and Go. Some of your competitors have started doing that now. Seems like you've been in that space longer than, let's say, Mariano's or some of those others. Is that, and then Target now has started doing it as well.
Yeah, the industry is catching on to it as you mentioned. I don't know. Mariano's has had it since I've been here. We had it last a year ago, November. I would tell you the one thing about being in New England. I was a big proponent of the Drive Up and Go with the climate in the Northeast, much like Chicago during the winter. It'd be much handier to drive up and get your groceries than getting out and braving the cold. And if you're fortunate to have children, taking children out of a warm car after you pick them up and take them into the grocery store, if you can just drive up, have your groceries put in your car, and you head home to prepare any kind of meals to take care of your kids.
And I guess the terminology here is this convenience shopping, right? Where is convenience shopping? What's the next logical step for that?
Quite frankly, I don't know how much more convenient it can get for customers. I mean, you talk about the self checkout, so that lets them do that, as you talked about earlier. You walk into a store and you walk out and no register and you just get a bill on your phone.
Yeah.
I don't know how much more convenient it can get. I mean, we'll deliver groceries within an hour. We'll schedule a day. You can order whatever you want from our stores. From a convenience factor, we have a website that's available. If there's something that you want that we don't have, you can order it and have it delivered to your house in a matter of time. So convenience is really, from the platforms that are out there, that's there. What we have to deliver, from the convenience factor is having what the customer wants when they want it. And that's always our challenge is how do we stay ahead of the customer? How do we stay ahead of events, a snowstorm, mm-hmm. or those type of activities where the customer immediately changes. And those are the challenges. How do we stay ahead of that customer?
Yeah, the last thing you probably want to hear is when those of us in the news media talk about empty store shelves ahead of a snowstorm, right?
Yeah. It's one of those difficult situations. Yes, it's good for sales when there's a storm pending and people have to buy what they anticipate grocery stores being closed for a week or two, which quite frankly doesn't happen, but it's a mindset. So they panic buy. So it helps as long as the event doesn't occur, because when a storm does force customers not to want to go out to brave it, there's absolutely no business done in the stores. And when you're dealing with a lot of fresh products, not having any customers for even a half a day is not a good situation.
You mentioned the trend in healthy food. I want to talk a little bit more about that, and also this explosion of home meal kits, with people having delivered these kits that they can prepare food at home. How is that impacting the supermarket experience?
Well, I don't know that it's necessarily impacting the supermarket business. If you've seen many retailers, including Jewel Osco, we have a plated option mm-hmm. to where those other meal kits had requirements that you purchase so many on a regular basis. We have them available in store. So you pick up the kit and you pick it up when you want to pick it up, not necessarily I have to prepare three meals this week with that program. So it gives the customer the flexibility. So I think the initial ramp up was very large on the meal kits as a solution to customers wanting to try something different and create some meals that maybe were outside of their bandwidth from a recipe standpoint, or they wouldn't try or didn't want to have to buy all the ingredients that it would require when they can get just what they need to try something a little bit different. So I think school's still out on that, on where that's going to grow. You know, we've been working on grab and go and replacement meals for 10 years to really fine tune that for the customer so that it's a heat and eat, quick, easy meals for them. So the plated brand that we promote is a great option for customers to take advantage of.
With the organic segment and the health food, what are the special challenges there in terms of ramping up, finding those suppliers and making sure that food's in the store when people come?
Well, it's getting simpler every day. Major manufacturers out there have now converted their manufacturing plants to produce organics. We, years ago, used to segregate and have all the organics and natural items in a different section of the store. The challenge today is the breadth and variety that's available out there and that the mainstream manufacturers are producing. You couldn't live within that landlock, so we've integrated those. If it's a cereal item, it's in the regular cereal aisle. If it's in a canned vegetable section, it's in the canned vegetable section. Just because as the consumers are shifting to the organics, they're not necessarily consuming more. It's shifting from the regular unorganic items to the organic. So you see a sales softening in the regular product shift.
As much as it's important to focus on what's on those shelves and what you have in your grocery store, how important is it for the display and the experience of the grocery store? And the reason I ask this is because recently Kroger and Microsoft announced that they're teaming up to do this sort of futuristic take on grocery stores. There's digital shelves that can change prices automatically, that have displays that can show food in different ways and show advertisements. Is that also the wave of the future, to have these more futuristic looking grocery stores?
Well, the electronic shelf tags have been around probably about 15 years. The challenge has always been they're not real, they don't scream "buy me" like some of the signage and some of the other programs that you can run. A lot of the monitors that you see up in stores today are designed to appeal to that person mm-hmm. that's looking for something new and something different. I think you'll see some of that, but again, we're a simple business and can't let ourselves get overcomplicated. We have to get the value to the consumer, and there's a cost to all those things that has to be weighed out. So, I believe in taking care of basics and then adding some excitement to that with displays and signage and those type of activities. But I can't answer what the future will hold. It may become all digital, and that could be the future.
And will there be drone delivery and robots in the stores and driverless cars bringing groceries to people?
You know, if I knew the exact date and timing of that, I'd probably be doing something different than selling groceries, because that has applications across it. I don't know. I was in Arizona on vacation and took one of the services to get from one place to another, and I was surprised they were talking about the driverless cars. I don't know if I'm ready to be sitting in the back seat of a car with no driver, hoping that the computer never goes down. And, you know, one of the things I tell my children, it's, you know, I've been using computers for a lot of years, and I've had tech issues before with some pretty good systems. I would hate to be in the back of that car when there's a tech issue or a communication or the internet goes down or the wireless signal goes down. That may be a little uncomfortable.
I want to ask you about an issue that we covered recently in the program regarding food waste and what impact and what role grocery stores and a chain like Jewel Osco might play in that. We waste billions and billions of pounds of food every year. Is there a role with grocery stores to maybe lessen that a little bit?
I believe there is, and you know, we work very closely with the Food Depository and the Northern Illinois Food Bank to minimize that to a great extent. I don't recall the exact number of pounds of food that normally would have hit waste, but we're able to freeze it, and the food banks and the food depositories are able to pick up that food to avoid a majority of that waste today. It's much better than 5 years ago, the amount of waste that was had out there that today is utilized for taking care of the people less fortunate.
I want to ask you a fun question because I know people in my life that still refer to Jewel as the Jewels or Jewels. What do you think when you hear that from people? Is that something you laugh at, or do you?
No, I think it's appropriate, and it's really a kind of a badge of that we're their home, and they reference us more like a friend than a business. And like I described, I had worked in Philadelphia. Acme is a long-term, over 100-year chain there. People don't refer to going grocery shopping in Philadelphia. They go, "I'm running to the Acme." When you talk about Shaw's in New England, it's the oldest continuous running grocery store in the United States, over 155 years. And, you know, it's Shaw's. It's not Shaw's. I'm going to Shaw's. So, you know, it's I really look at it as a term of endearment that we've been providing what they're looking for multiple years.
As a CEO, especially a grocery store CEO, do you have any New Year's resolutions that you're working on or you've already settled on?
Personally, yes. And business, we have some goals that were set that we want to continue to grow our business and grow our market share in the Chicagoland area and remain aggressive to do that.
At the end of the year, how will you measure that?
We have sales goals that we set, and we'll measure against that particular sales goal to see how we performed.
Well, Paul, it's wonderful meeting you. I'm happy you're here. Great conversation, and please come back and join us sometime.
All right, will do. Thank you.
Paul Gossett is the CEO of Jewel Osco, and we're going to continue our conversation with Paul after the bell this morning and post our full conversation with him in the podcast of The Opening Bell a little bit later this morning at WGNradio.com.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
On the WGN, Associated Bank Market Desk, futures are pointing toward opening losses on Wall Street later this morning. Dow futures down 207 points. Nearly 0.75%, S&P futures off nearly 1% now, and NASDAQ futures off more than 1%, down about 76 points, down about 1.25%. Let's get the latest on commodities and agriculture now, and good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Has not happened in the 100-year history of the American Farm Bureau Federation. For the second consecutive year, President Trump will address the nation's farmers in New Orleans at the 100th annual convention. Also, other Republicans and cabinet members who will be present, Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue, will also address the members of the Farm Bureau. And I think Vice President Mike Pence is still expected to be there as well. Yesterday, the American Farm Bureau presented its highest honor, the Distinguished Service Award, to Senator Orrin Hatch, and the State Farm Bureau Founders Award to Dick Neufer at the 100th annual convention. And Max Armstrong is there, and he'll be reporting to us on other activities at the Farm Bureau. Disease news and the problem in the news this morning. The U.S. Department of Agriculture's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service has confirmed another case of the virulent Newcastle disease in a third commercial poultry flock in California. The latest case is in a commercial layer flock in Riverside County, and this finding is part of an outbreak in Southern California that began in May of 2018 in backyard exhibition flocks. And one other disease report, China's agriculture ministry said a new outbreak of African swine fever had been confirmed in a province in the northwestern part of the country. Have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Thanks, Orion. You as well. Now the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk Outlook for Monday, January 14th. Producer prices, retail sales, housing starts, and consumer sentiment highlight all of this week's economic reports. Producer prices for December lead off tomorrow with the latest retail sales and business inventories in the spotlight on Wednesday. Thursday will bring December's housing starts and the weekly look at first-time unemployment claims, while Friday winds up with industrial production for December and January's preliminary consumer sentiment index. We're also moving into earnings season with Citigroup out of the gate today. Tomorrow, J.P. Morgan, Wells Fargo, Delta, and Chicago-based United earnings coming. Goldman Sachs, Bank of America, BlackRock on Wednesday. American Express and Netflix report earnings on Thursday. Just some of the things that could move the markets on this January 14th, Monday, 2019.